Okay, so to begin the material for today, most of you are aware that we're in this series of talks on what are called the 25 beautiful mind states. Now, for those who may not have been through the series, and we've been at it for quite a few weeks now, I'd just like to run through them very quickly, just as a way of giving you a sense of the magnitude or the breadth of what's implied in this teaching. Now, these 25 beautiful mind states are regarded as the qualities or the mental states that are achievable, that are attainable by those who are advanced in the spiritual practice. I mean, they certainly represent the mind states of the Buddha himself and all the great arahants of the past and all the great spiritual leaders of our modern age. So let me just run through this very quickly. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it because it's quite a long list. But it gives you a sense of the scope and the range of the mental landscape of a spiritually evolved person. First is confidence, a sense of confidence, presence in the world, feet firmly on the ground, totally centered, confidence. Confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and also confidence in one's self. Confidence in who one is, as well as confident in one's capacity to reach enlightenment. That's a huge sense of empowerment that one has. One feels empowered in terms of confidence. The second is mindfulness, the ability to exercise mindfulness. The third is, very interesting, shame and fear of harm. What this implies is a quality of moral and ethical rectitude that is so refined that just the thought of harming anyone, harming oneself or harming anyone, is enough to evoke shame and fear. So this is a very high moral standard. The thought of perpetrating any unskillful action incites a sense of shame and fear. Then there are certain qualities of character like non-attachment to things, goodwill, a sense of goodwill to all, a sense of equanimity and peace. And then there are a number of what I call mental factors, which to me just really, really powerful because they describe what we would consider to be perfect mental health. One is called composure of mind. The mind is composed all the time. The second is buoyancy of mind, a lightness of mind and body. Pliancy of mind, which is flexibility, malleability, and a kind of non-resistance of mind that fights rigidity and resistance. It's a mind that flows into all things. To me, this is the definition of intelligence. This is what intelligence is, a mind that is pliant and buoyant, and efficiency of mind, a mind that's efficient. The mind and the body work effectively for wholesome action without struggle or effort. And then a mind that is proficient, great facility and competence, both physically and mentally. So these are beautiful, beautiful characteristics to be able to embody within oneself. And the next one is rectitude of mind. A mind that is morally and ethically straight and upright. So this goes along with shame and fear of harm. So we have composure of mind, buoyancy of mind, pliancy of mind, efficiency of mind, proficiency of mind, and rectitude of mind. Then out of these qualities arise right speech, right action, right livelihood. In other words, this leads to a virtuous, wholesome, skillful life in terms of what we say, what we do, and our livelihoods, what we do in the world. And then out of that right living in the world arises compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So these are the qualities of the heart that emerge in spiritually evolved beings. And the last is wisdom. Wisdom is the final encompassing quality, if you will, that sense of understanding and wisdom that one brings to the world. Now, in our previous talk last week, we began our discussion of wisdom, and we spoke about wisdom in terms of what is the difference between wisdom and intelligence, what's the difference between being smart and being wise. And then we also discussed the process, if you will, of attaining wisdom in the Buddhist tradition. So, to roughly summarize, this process of attaining wisdom is a threefold process and can be sort of roughly summarized as follows. First, one learns the Buddhist teachings through texts and personal instruction, which builds a solid conceptual foundation of the teaching. So this is the initial learning process. It allows one to become aware of the structure of experience, to become progressively more aware of one's self, and to clarify the nature of one's experience. So this is the basic learning process. Secondly, through critical reflection on those teachings, one overcomes personal hindrances and obstacles and assimilates the teachings into one's view of life. So this is when we start to internalize the teachings. One goes from words to their meaning, from what past teachers meant to what it may mean for one's self. Through this process of self-reflection, one is able to reach a clear intellectual understanding and a sense of certainty of the teachings for oneself. And then thirdly, through the application of mindfulness meditation, now this is the crucial part, once we've intellectually learned these concepts, the teachings of the Dharma, we subject it to meditation. So through the application of mindfulness, one is able to simply observe with what is called metacognitive awareness, to see the teachings as they arise in our mind. It is through this metacognitive awareness, we can see mental events as mental events, thoughts as thoughts. We learn to disidentify with the discursive mind and ultimately recognize awareness itself. Now this reaches to the highest levels of what one can attain in the mindfulness process, and we'll talk about this in more detail later. But in terms of the content of the teachings, it is at this point that the meditator comes to actually experience the qualities and mind states of impermanence, suffering, and non-self, as well as the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion, and the four noble truths. Now, these are the cornerstones of the Dharma teachings. Impermanence, suffering, and non-self, greed, hatred, and delusion, the three poisons, and the four noble truths. Ultimately, it comes down to the four noble truths. Now, having said this, it's important to talk about the opposite. So, what is the opposite of wisdom? According to the sutras, it said, when there are reasons for doubt, uncertainty is born. So in this case, as the Buddha preached in the sutras, don't go by unconfirmed reports, by legends, rumor, hearsay, by traditions, by scriptures, by conjecture, surmise, by inference, by axioms, by analogies, reflection on superficial appearances, by pondering views or delighting in opinions and speculations. When you know for yourselves that these qualities are unskillful, blameworthy, and criticized by the wise, that these qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to harm and to suffering, then you should abandon them. All decrees representing any form of dogmatism or blind faith are to be vigorously rejected. So the opposite of wisdom is ignorance, and delusion is one of the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion. Now, of these three poisons, ignorance or delusion is viewed as the worst because it impairs our ability to follow the Noble Eightfold Path, which is the path to the cessation of suffering. So ignorance is the primary obstacle to awakening. And it's the awakening process that leads us to final enlightenment. So ignorance is the primary sort of hindrance, the wall, the blockage. According to the Buddha, ignorance is the leader in the attainment of unskillful qualities, followed by lack of conscience and lack of concern. That's an interesting trilogy. Ignorance is the worst. It's followed by a lack of conscience and a lack of concern. Now, the word that resonates for me is conscience. What is conscience? Conscience is the lack of a sense of moral consequence. The person doesn't have any conscience. It means he doesn't care, he doesn't have a sense of the rightness or the wrongness of the moral consequences of his actions. So this really highlights the importance of morality and ethics, which is really the foundation of the entire Dharma teaching. It's the foundation of the practice, conscience. Ignorance is the worst, because ignorance is ignorance. You just don't know anything. If you don't have conscience, then you're not aware of the moral, ethical implications of your actions. And lack of concern, well, you don't care. So, I mean, these are pretty significant hindrances to wisdom. Now, in the scriptures it says, in the mind of ignorance, wrong view arises. With wrong view, wrong intention arises. This leads to wrong speech, which leads to wrong action. These continual habits of unskillful speech and action lead to wrong livelihood. In one of wrong livelihood, wrong effort. In one of wrong effort, wrong mindfulness. In one of wrong mindfulness, wrong concentration arises. So the mind of ignorance cannot calm the mind enough to meditate due to a life of harmful and unskillful actions. And without meditation, one cannot attain the wisdom to liberate oneself from suffering. Now there are, in my mind, two major ideas in this paragraph. One is the importance of karma. What is karma? Karma is the sequence of effects that go from wrong view, opinion, a belief, whatever thought you might have, leads to a wrong intention. So the thought leads to an intention. The intention leads to a word, speech, something we say, which leads to a wrong action. And these wrong actions lead to wrong livelihood. So this is the chain, this is the karmic chain. A thought leads to an intention, intention leads to a word leads to an action, the action leads to a livelihood, and it becomes who we are. So this is the chain that leads to consequences in the world. A thought leads to a way of life, a livelihood. And in this case, wrong livelihood. So this primary idea that everything starts from the mind. A right thought leads to right speech, right action, right livelihood. Wrong thought leads to wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood. So this is how karma plays out, starting from thoughts down to actions. Now the second idea that's very important is that when we exist in this world of wrong actions and wrong livelihood, we do not have the clarity of mind to be able to actually meditate, because our mind is caught up with greed, hatred, delusion, anger, all these wrong, unskillful thoughts. We lack clarity of mind. We lack the ability to clear the mind, to come to a calm, still mind, which is, of course, the basis for meditation. This is what allows us to begin to see the truth of things, allows us to come to a calm and still mind, which leads to a mind of mindfulness, which then becomes the road to wisdom and understanding. So all of this is foreclosed with wrong thought, right, wrong speech, and wrong action, or ignorance. So this ignorance, as we were saying before, is the primary, strongest obstacle to wisdom. Now, the whole concept of wisdom itself is really the culmination of the practice. As we were saying, it's the culmination of the 25 beautiful mind states. But it occupies this very, very primary position as the culmination of the Eightfold Noble Path. Of course, the Eightfold Noble Path is the fourth noble truth of the Four Noble Truths. So you can see it's placed right in the middle of the teaching, and it's seen as the culmination of the practice, the Eightfold Noble Path itself. Now, this Eightfold Noble Path is the path, as described by the Buddha and taught by the Buddha, that develops profound wisdom, profound virtue, and unwavering concentration. So these are the three sort of primary characteristics, or primary virtues, if you will, that are cultivated through the Eightfold Noble Path. And these are the refined qualities that are necessary to awaken, to attain full maturity, as the Buddha teaches us, as the path to enlightenment. Now, for those who may not be aware, the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth is the truth of suffering. And that points to the reality of suffering in our lives. And it implies an understanding of ignorance in the sense of the lack of wisdom as to the truth of human existence. In other words, we don't understand that life is suffering. Because we don't understand that, we dwell in suffering. So ignorance is the primary cause of suffering. Not aware of the fact that suffering fills our lives. And the second noble truth is that we're not aware that clinging and craving are shown to be the causes of suffering. Clinging and craving is one of what are called the three poisons: greed, hatred, and delusion. So it's either craving and clinging for things that we desire, or aversion for things that we don't desire, that are unpleasant. And delusion is not knowing that we're caught up in this cycle of craving and aversion, craving and aversion. The third noble truth shows that the end of suffering is possible. We don't have to be caught up in this endless cycle of greed, hatred, and delusion. And the fourth noble truth, which is the Eightfold Noble Path, points to the path leading to the end of suffering. So the Eightfold Noble Path is really the sort of framework for the entire practice. Now, if we look at these eight path factors, the first two path factors are right view and right intention. It starts with what are called the two wisdom factors, right view and right intention. These are the factors that develop wisdom. These are the wisdom factors. The second three are right speech, right action, and right livelihood. These are called the moral and ethical factors. These are the venues in our lives where we play out skillful, unskillful, moral, immoral, harmful, or harmless, or positive actions in our life through our speech, through our actions, and through our livelihoods. So the first is wisdom, the wisdom group, the wisdom qualities. The second are the moral and ethical qualities, how we live a moral and ethical life. And the last three are right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So these support developing the meditative practice, because the meditation is the vehicle, is the means by which we develop wisdom and right virtue. So it can be said that an awakened human being is an ongoing expression of these three qualities: wisdom, virtue, and concentration, the three primary qualities. So as is stated in the sutras, it is for the full comprehension, clear understanding, and the ending and abandonment of suffering that the Noble Eightfold Path is to be cultivated. Now, according to a renowned Dharma teacher by the name of John Haspel, right view is initially the perspective that your views of life have been lacking understanding, lacking wisdom. This lack of wisdom has given rise to craving and clinging, leading to unhappiness and suffering. So suffering is represented as a distracted mind born of ignorance. We're constantly distracted by pleasure and pain and greed, hatred, and delusion. Preoccupation with suffering is the distraction that keeps one in ignorance. So we're caught in this cycle of ignorance, greed, hatred, and delusion. And this is what holds us in suffering. But the task associated with the First Noble Truth is the complete understanding of suffering. To acknowledge that we suffer, due to clinging and craving, and that we desire to be freed from our suffering. So the first step, in awakening is to be able to see the suffering in our lives, to become aware of the suffering in our lives. And of course, the skills required to accomplish the task of understanding suffering are heightened concentration, insight, and refined mindfulness. So this is the beginning of understanding wisdom, by acknowledging the suffering in our lives. Now, without the initial recognition that wisdom and understanding in the context of the Four Noble Truths is lacking, it will be impossible to develop the understanding leading to the cessation of suffering. We cannot remove suffering until we acknowledge that suffering is there. Acknowledging that it is your own lack of wisdom that has caused delusion and suffering can be difficult at first. Of course, this is the hardest thing to acknowledge, that we do suffer and the ways in which we suffer. So until this initial step is taken, your mind will reject developing any kind of understanding. Your mind will remain wandering around in ignorance looking for any distraction to avoid seeing the truth. And this is generally how we operate. It will be impossible to attain lasting happiness and peace without first acknowledging your present quality of mind. Achieving liberation and freedom from suffering cannot be realized without first accepting the truth of suffering and its causes. Now, as I was reading this and thinking upon it, a whole list of words came to my mind. Avoidance, distraction, denial, transcendence. In other words, all the ways we use to escape acknowledging suffering in our lives. Pain, grief, anger, jealousy, guilt, remorse, anxiety, woundedness, lack of self-esteem, lack of confidence, anger. We do anything to avoid confronting these mind states that constantly arise in our mind. And none of us are immune from these kinds of mind states. So we try to avoid them. We distract ourselves by drugs and alcohol, watching TV, compulsive eating, getting involved in risky kinds of sports like bungee jumping or, you know, high-risk kinds of activities to just get our mind off of what's going on, you know, within ourselves, the suffering that we're experiencing. These are forms of distraction. These are forms of denial. These are forms of avoidance and even forms of transcendence. We try to transcend our way out of suffering by oftentimes meditators fall into this trap. If I can get into high states of jhanic samadhi, states of rapture and bliss, I'm transcending my suffering. But if you're not applying the mindfulness to actually see the suffering, you're just going right over it. And you're not even seeing it. But then when you come back, as the Buddha did himself, when he came back from these heightened mind states, he realized that he hasn't changed. He hadn't changed at all. He's still the same person. He's still subject to greed, hatred, and delusion. So how do we root out, these kilesas, they're called kilesas, these defilements of greed, hatred, and delusion? It only can come through mindfulness, not through avoidance, distraction, denial, or any one of these strategies that we use to hide ourselves from what is really going on within ourselves. As I was reflecting on this, one thing that came to my mind, and this might have come to your mind also, in the work that I've been doing, I've often worked with people who are subject to addictions, alcohol and drug addictions, and one of the things that I encountered was the 12-step program. Many of you probably have heard about the 12-step program, and this is the Bible of the whole treatment process used to rehabilitate people who are addicted in various forms of drugs or alcohol or certain forms of addictive behavior. And the first step in the 12-step sequence is to admit that we are addicted. Admit that we are powerless over our addiction, that our lives have become unmanageable. So any form of transformation, any form of healing, has to be based on the acknowledgement of the suffering. You've got to acknowledge the suffering. You've got to see the suffering. You've got to open to the suffering. You have to be honest with yourself and have the courage and the openness and the acceptance to open to your negative mind states. Suffering becomes the doorway to awakening. And this is the thing that most people don't understand about Buddhism. They say, oh, it's all about suffering. It's all about suffering. Yes, it is about suffering. But it's about suffering as the means to awakening, because through suffering we come to understanding. Understanding can only happen when we confront our suffering. We have to confront it in order to understand it. And by understanding it, we come to wisdom. So we don't awaken by escaping our negative mind states. We have to acknowledge them and try to understand why we suffer. This is the key question in the entire spiritual process. Why do I suffer? And what can I do to free myself from this suffering? So without the initial recognition that wisdom and understanding in the context of the Four Noble Truths is lacking, it will be impossible to develop the understanding leading to the cessation of suffering. Acknowledging that it is your own lack of wisdom that has caused delusionment and suffering can be difficult, as we were saying. So, right view, because of these constraints and the difficulties, right view develops gradually. It doesn't come overnight. It's the result of a process. And this process is the process of mindfulness. So initially, an understanding that life in the world is stressful and the cause of stress or suffering is clinging begins the development of wisdom. Right view develops the understanding that penetrates to the root of suffering, and developing this right view is the development of wisdom. So wisdom only comes through our confrontation with our dark side, our suffering, our negative emotions. So the Buddha describes right view. He says, "And what is right view? Right view is knowledge with regard to suffering, knowledge with regard to the origination of suffering, knowledge with regard to the cessation of suffering, and knowledge with regard to the path or practice that leads to the end of suffering. This is right view." So, in essence, what he's describing is the Four Noble Truths. The acknowledgement of suffering, the acknowledgement of the cause of suffering, acknowledging the possibility of the cessation of suffering, and the path or practice that leads to the end of suffering. So right view is knowledge and understanding of the Four Noble Truths. Right view is a view that supports the development of concentration and wisdom, which are the other two factors. So right view, in this case, is therefore considered the forerunner of the path. So it's this right view in terms of acknowledgement of suffering that leads to a more virtuous life, morally and ethically, and it leads to concentration and meditation, which reaches fruition in wisdom. So it starts with wisdom, it goes through the virtual morality and ethics, it goes through meditation, and it arrives at a higher level of wisdom. As is stated in the sutras, "And how is right view the forerunner? One discerns wrong view as wrong view and right view as right view. And what is wrong view? There is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. There is no fruit or result of good or bad actions. There is no this world, no next world, no mother, no father, no spontaneously reborn beings, no Brahmins or contemplatives who, living and practicing rightly, proclaim this world and the next after having directly knowing and realizing it for themselves." Now, what the Buddha is doing here is describing the ignorance and the consequences of wrong view. What he means is, when he says, there is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed, means that clinging, craving, desire, and aversion to objects, views, and ideas are maintained, not given up. Nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. In other words, it's the status quo. I just continue to hold on to the things I value and I hate the things I don't like. The next quote, there is no fruit or result of good or bad actions, means that there is no understanding or appreciation of the consequences of our actions. No understanding or appreciation of karma. Next, there is no this world, no next world, no mother, no father, no spontaneously reborn beings, no Brahmins or contemplatives who, living and practicing rightly, proclaim this world and the next after having directly knowing and realizing it for themselves. That refers to a complete lack of understanding of the process of becoming, or the process of karma and rebirth in terms of how it extends from this life into the next life. So a wrong view is the view that binds one to the phenomenal world of attainment, acquisition, and attachment, greed, hatred, and delusion. It binds us to this world. So in the beginning, wrong view is simply recognized. As right view is developed, actions originating in wrong view are gradually attenuated and abandoned. So this is a process. It is wrong view that continues to develop karma, and it is wrong view that, due to karma, causes rebirth in the next life. Wrong view is caused by ignorance, and right view is an expression of wisdom. So also the Buddha explains how right effort and right mindfulness directly contribute to developing wisdom by bringing the understanding of right view into full realization. One tries to abandon wrong view and enter into right view. This is one's right effort. One is mindful to abandon wrong view and to enter and remain in right view. This is one's right effort. Mindfulness. Thus, these three qualities, right view, right effort, and right mindfulness, run circle around right view. So it's a virtuous circle. Right view leads to right effort and right mindfulness, and it comes back around to right view. So we start with wisdom as the recognition of suffering, which leads to right effort and right mindfulness, which then leads to wisdom as the abandonment of wrong view and the attainment of right view. So it's a circular, upwardly moving, virtuous cycle. So right view supports and informs all of the components of the Eightfold Noble Path. Right view brings wisdom to a mind previously stuck in ignorance and confusion. Okay, I think I'll end it for today. There's still right intention, which I wanted to talk about, and we can speak about this again next week. But I think the whole idea here is to understand, you know, there's a confluence of principles, there's a confluence of concepts that flow and work together in terms of wisdom. How wisdom works in terms of right view, and how that leads to right effort in terms of doing what arises in order to address wrong view, and allowing us to come to a practice of concentration and meditation. So the wrong view moves into right, you know, right effort, which moves into right mindfulness. And that right mindfulness results or flowers into right wisdom in terms of the attainment of right view and the abandonment of wrong view. And this is seen as a process of gradual attenuation. So this is something that happens over time. It might take years. It might take, you know, it's a process of learning that we go through as we begin to understand conditioning, as we begin to understand karma in terms of how our conditioning from our previous lives and from our lives create wrong view. They create the patterns of attachment and aversion and conditioning that occupy our thoughts, that are the contents of our thoughts that begin to drive our behavior, that activate wrong view because they are conditioned by attachments, greed, hatred, and delusion. What is pleasant, what is unpleasant, and our constant craving for the pleasant and aversion to the unpleasant. In Sigmund Freud's term, the pleasure principle. Maximizing pleasure and minimizing pain. So this is how we live. And this is conditioned in our lives and it runs through our thoughts. And these thoughts drive our actions and they drive our lives. Now the mindfulness is this ability to disidentify and step back and see how these thoughts drive our lives through greed, hatred, and delusion, the three poisons, and step back and disidentify from that so that we're not driven by these thoughts, we're not driven by these compulsions that perpetuate wrong view, wrong speech, wrong intention, wrong action. So it's almost as if we're literally disengaging. We're sort of disengaging from this energy stream of karma that's moving through our lives, this conditioned set of intentions and motivations that drive us, and based on basically what are the Darwinian laws of natural selection, the survival of the fittest, which energize and drive our lives from lifetime to lifetime to lifetime. So when we say disidentify and step out of the stream of the torrent of thoughts that drive our lives, what we're doing is we're seeing this stream of energy that moves through our lives that perpetuates the pleasure principle of maximizing pleasure and avoiding pain. So we're able to step aside from it. We see it for what it is. And we see that who we think we are is the self that's embodied in that process. It's the self that's embodied in my thoughts, what I think, my discursive mind, is who I think I am. That is myself. It's an artifact. It's a product of conditioning. It's a product of karma. Self is an illusion. Once we start to see that, we disidentify from that self, which is this current that moves through our lives, this current that we call karma. This is the energy of conditioning and cause and effect that defines who we think we are. It defines what we think our self is. But this is an illusion. It's an impersonal product of the conditioning forces of our lives that colors the way we see the world and the choices we make. And this is the embodiment of wrong view. Wrong view in the sense that it's ensconced in greed, hatred, and delusion. Delusion or ignorance in terms of not knowing that we're caught up in this endless stream of karma that moves through us, this energy of karma, and not being able to disengage. Literally step back and let the stream go and see it for what it is. And the capacity that allows us to do that is the capacity for awareness. It's the capacity for mindfulness. It's the ability to see what's happening in our mind. This is the metacognitive awareness that we speak of, which is embodied in mindfulness. So we see who we really are. We see who we really are. This is the wisdom that leads to freedom. Because we're no longer identified with that karmic stream, that karmic energy that runs through our lives. We don't have to be that self that we think we are. Now, in the world, we are that self. We are that self in the sense that we are this artifact that is this personification of our conditioning and our thoughts and our beliefs and our habits. So we bring that wisdom back into our lives so that we live lives that are wholesome, that are skillful, that are positive, that are loving, generous, compassionate, wise, and peaceful. So there's a kind of feedback loop. The feedback is we can see, we can disengage, we can step back, and we can see this wrong energy that's moving through our lives, this ignorance. Once we can step back and see it, we're no longer in ignorance because we can see it. We're in ignorance when we don't see it, when it's unconscious. But when it becomes conscious, that is the beginning of understanding. That is the beginning of seeing the reality of who we truly are. And we can bring the consequence of wise reflection upon that seeing back into our lives so that our lives become more skillful, more wholesome, more positive, more full of love, compassion, generosity, loving kindness, and peace. This is the cycle. This is the cycle of wisdom as it arises through the understanding of suffering and plays back into our lives to transform our lives for the better. So this is how awakening becomes part of who we are. Okay, thank you all so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to articulate these ideas because they're so important. They're really so important, and they form the basis for our personal transformation. And we all are works in progress. We all are works in progress. So this is a lifelong process of self-discovery and transformation that occurs as we move, as we continue this process of inquiry and understanding. Thank you all so much.